Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Patentability of Human Genes Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On April 15, 2013, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Association for Molecular Pathology v. Myriad Genetics, Incorporated. The issue in the case is whether human genes are patentable. To discuss the case, we have Gregory Dolan, who is an associate professor and co-director of the Center for Medicine and Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Dolan.
So on April 15, Supreme Court heard arguments in Association for Molecular Pathology versus Myriad Genetics. The issue in that case, as framed by the Supreme Court in its grant of petition for certiorari, is whether human genes are patent-eligible subject matter. And that question is a fairly broad one, presented as a fairly broad one by petitioners on purpose, because they wanted to get a broad ruling from the Supreme Court on this issue. The basic dispute between the petitioners and the amici on their side and the respondents and the amici on their side is this question of whether the genetic information carrying molecule should be viewed of as a chemical entity, in which case, as any new chemical that does not exist in nature, it should fairly easily be construed as patent eligible, or whether it has more is a more functional entity, whether it's information carrying, in which case the function of the molecule, whether inside the body or outside the body, at least as argued by the petitioners, doesn't change, and therefore isolated portion of DNA is not in fact anything new that's created by human hands, but is naturally occurring substance. And that was the sort of the scientific dispute. The policy dispute, of course, is much broader because it goes into the question of what are the proper incentives for innovation between scientists and people working in the field of genetics versus what are the costs of such incentives, including potentially exorbitant prices for genetic tests, future genetic treatments, as well as locking up potentially basic tools of scientific research for future downstream research in with the same genes. So the issue was fairly squarely teed up for the Supreme Court. There were a number of prominent entities and scientists on both sides of the issue. For example, for the petitioners, Dr. James Watson of Watson Crick, a double helix fame, submitted an amicus brief on the respondent side. Dr. Ananda Chakrabarty, famous from the case of Chakrabarty versus Diamond, or Diamond versus Chakrabarty, submitted a brief. And the Supreme Court certainly had a wealth of both scientific and legal arguments to draw on. The argument, however, indicated perhaps Supreme Court is not particularly clear on the way that patent law works, as much less the way the science works. Throughout most of the hour-long argument, the court, instead of focusing really on the science at hand, with some notable exceptions, mostly focused on analogies to the question. So, for example, Justice Sotomayor tried to compare the DNA in question to chocolate chip cookies. Chief Justice Roberts talked about baseball bats. Justice Alito and Justice Kagan talked about trees and rainforest. So it was fairly clear that the court was not particularly comfortable with science, although the discussion got better as the argument went on. The court also was not quite sure as to where should incentive line properly be drawn. The petitioners argued that even absent patent protection for isolated DNA molecules, scientists will continue to work and continue to create these molecules and continue to discover what particular piece of DNA code for and what do they do and what they're capable of, because scientists chase things like Nobel Prizes, recognition in the scientific community, and general pursuit of scientific truth. Fairly early on in the argument, Justice Kennedy expressed skepticism of that position. He said that we can't just take your word for it, meaning petitioners' word for it, that that will be sufficient incentive for innovation simply because somebody at some point can win a Nobel Prize. At the same time, when the respondent got to argue their position, the justices were equally skeptical that the respondent simply is failing to draw any sort of line between what is a naturally occurring substance, which patent law has held for quite some time, is not patent eligible, and what is made by human hands. So, for example, Justice Kagan tried to get the Respondents' Council to admit or at least explain somehow whether or not full chromosome is patent eligible, and then she asks, is a cell patent eligible, and ultimately asks if a kidney and a liver is patent eligible subject matter, or is it a product of nature? And the Respondents' Council, despite pretty clear resistance from the court that they certainly were not going to hold that a first person to isolate a liver would be able to patent it, even if nobody knew about what liver does beforehand, was not willing to make that concession. So the court was certainly worried about the respondent's position as to where that would fall and how they were to adopt that, how much would they sweep under the potential umbrella of patent protection. And they were not clearly uncomfortable with having patent protection be that broad. Somewhere in the middle was the position of the United States, arguing as amicus and represented by Solicitor General Verrilli. The United States government argued that the line should be drawn between simply an excised portion of DNA. So if you take a chromosome and take a piece of it out without doing any further modifications, leaving the entire sequence intact and simply just cleaving it from a larger piece. They argued that that should not be patent eligible because all you're doing is taking a smaller piece from a bigger piece. On the other hand, if that piece, once excised, is modified to remove all the non-coding regions and only leave regions that are coding, even though the function of the molecule may not significantly change, because ultimately you're leaving only coding regions, that should be patent eligible because that has sufficient amount of human intervention, just merely excising to excising and ultimately chemically modifying the molecule. And from the, of course, it's very perilous to predict how the court will come out, but from the questions, it seemed that that may very well be where the court will draw the line, simply because drawing the line saying that DNA is completely not patent eligible did not seem to win many votes, at least was met with skepticism, as I've described before. And the line that respondents appear to try to draw, that almost everything is patent eligible and other doctrines should be used to ultimately narrow the scope of the patent, also did not seem to carry the day. So ultimately, I think the question in this case for practitioners of patent law is not what will and what will not be held to be patent eligible, because I think the court will draw the line, as I've indicated, between man-modified DNA, so cDNA, and merely excised DNA, and say that merely excised DNA falls on an ineligible line and cDNA falls on an eligible line. But the question is sort of how broadly the opinion will be written and how clearly the opinion will be written. I think from a number of post-argument discussions, as well as observing the court on the bench, I think, again, it was pretty clear the court simply did not fully comprehend the science or the import, economic or scientific imports, of the debate that was being sort of held right in front of them. And depending on sort of the scope of the opinion, the court may very well sufficiently or significantly reduce varieties of incentive to innovate in the area of medical genetics. That remains to be seen depending on what the opinion will actually say, but that was certainly a concern given sort of the tone of the questions and the type of questions that were being asked. The other sort of strange thing about this case is ultimately the respondents have said both privately and publicly, including their SEC filings, that whether or not they win or lose the case themselves, it really will not have much effect on their own business, that these particular patents are about to expire. Even if they're upheld, they'll expire in 2014, and that they have a number of other patents that have not been challenged, and that they'll be just fine in terms of their business and in terms of their profits. And so that again goes to the question of whether that the respondents don't particularly care about their patents, but the question is, what will the courts do not so much with these particular patents, but how broadly they will write the opinion for other genetic and personalized medicine that deals with biologic molecules, not just chemical molecules that we are used to in tablet form, but biological molecules such as proteins, such as small DNA molecules, and so on. So hopefully the court will realize its own limitations in terms of scientific knowledge and try to write a narrow opinion, whichever way it comes out. But that's something to watch out for once it comes out by sometime July 1st. And I think I'll certainly be watching it, and I hope that the court will come out with carefully reasoned and fairly narrow opinion.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.